Hello, I'm Victor Nuremberg, and this is SciTech File on Radio Canada International. Valentine's Day is approaching, and for many people, it's all about a bouquet of fresh-cut flowers. But as you'll soon hear, to make the most of the bouquet's bouquet, as in its delightful fragrance, it's best to get out of bed. First, though, some unfinished business. This week on SciTech File, we conclude our conversation with Luciano Durante. Dr. Durante is chair of archival studies at the University of British Columbia and leader of the InterParis Project, a multinational, multidisciplinary endeavor to safeguard the official record of the digital era. That could involve anything from a city map or piece of legislation to an interactive work of art. As we heard in part one last week, the digital age has, for the first time, created uncertainty about the official record and our ability to preserve it for future generations.
Because with digital material, the original disappears in the moment in which we save the record for the first time, because it breaks down in all of its digital parts. And every time we recall it, we create a copy, which is never identical to the previous one. Then we can no longer say that something is authentic or not. We have to find other ways of inferring that something is authentic.
And that's where we pick up our conversation today. Looking for ways to preserve the record in an age where the originals are typically no more than a stream of zeros and ones, bits and bytes. When it comes to governments and other institutions with organized and systematic procedures, the task is daunting but manageable. The real challenge, says Dr. Durante, lies in interactivity, when the actions and reactions of the computer are themselves part of the record.
When we're dealing with artists, and when we're dealing with scientists, whenever we have a situation in which, in order to have a record, two or more different entities have to interact, the difficulty is not to preserve the entities, is to maintain their ability to interact when they are moved from a technology to another. So, for example, one of the case studies is a musical piece called Obsessed Again, which was composed by one very well-known Canadian composer whose name is Keith Hamill, and was composed for bassoon and computer. So the bassoon would play a score and with a specific pitch, and the computer would react to this, generating itself sound. So you get like the sound of an orchestra, if you wish, together, but it only is stimulated by the bassoon that plays in a certain way. This system has been designed on technology that is now obsolete. So when the information from this technologies moved to the next one, when you play the bassoon, there is no reaction of the computer, or there is a different one. So you don't have the piece anymore. You can't play that piece anymore. It's gone. We have the recording, but you can hear the recording, but you cannot reproduce that sound anymore. So what is missing in all of this is the fact that the interaction between the technology and the human beings or the musical instruments is not documented. There is not a notation system that allows, just like the score describes the music, gives instructions for playing, the interaction gives instructions for designing a program that would be different from the previous one, but would yield the same result when it interacts with the musical instrument.
So how do you get around that problem?
Well, that's what we are doing. We are developing also this, for the music, this sort of notation system. This InterParis research is composed of three parts: the arts, the sciences, and government. And in each one of these parts, we have researchers who are people who generate the material. So in the arts, we have musicians and we have dancers, choreographers, theater people, etc. And then we have people who are expert in preservation, so archivists. Then we have people who are experts in technology, computer scientists, engineers, etc. So each group is a team of all the people who need to be involved in all of this. And each group would develop guidelines for those who generate the material on how to generate it in a way that can be preserved, and would also develop a sort of policy framework, which is both for those who generate the technology to be used and for those who use the technology.
So until this project reaches a successful conclusion, and I presume it will at some point, can we assume, therefore, that we have a period in our history now that is, in fact, blank, that there is no permanent record?
Yep. We have already lost a lot. In the past 30 years of records, we have lost, I would believe, the majority of the records of the first and second generations of computers. Fortunately, because people have been so diffident about the use of technology, in most cases, we have enough paper trail for each transaction that we have not lost the information, even if we have lost records. But certainly, we are in a very difficult situation, and we are trying, because the problem is that the technology changes faster than any ability to catch up with it. And that's why this kind of research that we are doing is not the kind of research that is ever finished. Because, yes, we do find the solutions and the answer for the generation of technology of 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So the moment in which it comes to initial preservation, then we know how to do that. But in the meanwhile, new problems are coming up. The biggest problem we have is obsolescence. That is the biggest one, and that is not going to go away because obsolescence is induced by the market. So what we have to do is to learn to live with obsolescence, and to learn to carry forward our material in a very careful way from a system to another, because before it becomes inaccessible. The disk may last 100 years, but that's totally irrelevant if you can't read the information on it after 3 years. What we have to do is not to stop progress, but try to channel it in a way that can be disciplined.
Discipline. It all comes down to that. Simple idea. Tall order. Because not only must that discipline be applied in Keith Hamill's music lab in Vancouver or at Vancouver City Hall, it has to be applied anywhere and everywhere that computers are used. You get the picture. But Dr. Durante and the InterParis project she leads intend on developing and applying the new standards around the world.
We have a very close contact with ISO, which is the International Standard Organization, and we have people in ISO committees. And as we develop as a global research project that involves all these countries, as we develop our own guidelines and recommendations and frameworks, basically they are fed into the standards organization, not just ISO, but, for example, the International Council on Archives and so on. And it does help that these frameworks that we develop are actually developed by people from many different disciplines and from many different cultures and countries and legal systems, because if they were all developed, let's say, by the Canadians, and by Canadian archivists, then it would take 20 years to adapt them to every social, legal, cultural environment before they can be accepted. But this way, they're already international. They're already developed by an international body. So, in a way, the acceptance process happens in the development of these frameworks and standards. And they are already tested and implemented in each country that participates in the research. So, in many ways, they are de facto standard already. The point is that in the past, we could forget the records and 500 years later find them. Now, if you do not decide proactively to preserve something specifically and don't do something about it, you lose it. So the default is losing everything. Before, the default was keeping everything. Before, if you didn't destroy something, you had it. It could become almost illegible. It could have holes in it, but you still had it. You could walk, as it happened, in the St. Petersburg Public Library and find the scores of the Bach's children 2 centuries later, by accident. Now, a piece of music, if you have not actively preserved the ability to reperform it, within 2 years from the creation, is gone. And same thing for any other form of art, or for any other form of science, or for any record that attests our rights. Because that's the other thing. With e-government, all the records are going to be in electronic form and are going to be in the hands of the government and of the government's ability to maintain them authentic through time. And there is no way for the citizen of controlling that.
Luciana Durante is the director of the InterParis Project, based at the School of Library, Archival, and Information Studies at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. She's also chair of that school. Countries participating in InterParis include China, Australia, the Netherlands, Italy, Botswana, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada. A link to InterParis can be found on the SciTechFile website at rcinet.ca/SciTechFile. You're listening to SciTechFile on Radio Canada International. Valentine's Day is almost upon us again. For those of you unfamiliar with the tradition, the 14th of February is the day set aside to express our love to those we hold dear. For flower vendors and chocolate manufacturers, it's the day of the year they hold dearest of all. You may be asking yourself, why is a science program concerning itself with matters of the heart? Well, we're not, really. It's the flowers that caught our attention. Or more to the point, their enchanting and intoxicating scents. If you're planning on presenting your loved one with flowers next week and want to make the most of the occasion, here is some science-based advice. Ensure the recipient is upright. Tempted as you may be to present that bouquet while the object of your affection is lying supine in bed, researchers in Montreal have discovered that in that position, our sense of smell is diminished. Like many scientific discoveries, this one too was by accident. Doctors Marilyn Jones Gottman and Johan Lundstrom hadn't set out to explore how well our noses functioned in different anatomical positions. That arose, says neuropsychologist Dr. Jones Gottman, as the only explanation for an anomaly in some of their experimental results. She and Dr. Lundstrom had exposed their subjects to different intensities of a particular odor, using a device known as an olfactometer, which delivers a measured dose to the nostrils.
What happened was that we were doing a brain imaging study in which we wanted to compare activations in the brain when people would be smelling putative human pheromone versus a normal, let's call it normal odor. And we were presenting these substances at a low concentration, whereas in most of our brain imaging studies, all of the odors that we present were well, well above threshold. So strong. But these were not strong, and we were presenting them using an olfactometer, whereas before, in all of our studies, we had wafted odors into the nostril with a couple of different ways, but not using an olfactometer. So in that particular study, we didn't get any brain activations. And this was a disappointment and a bit of a shock. And we were trying to determine why that happened. And we thought it was probably the olfactometer, which was a cheap, crummy little olfactometer. I mean, we have a very fancy one now, but this was one that we had borrowed. It was very simple. And we thought that somehow the odorants were losing their pizzazz as they went through the olfactometer, that they weren't strong enough. And we had another hypothesis that the substance that we were using was of poor quality. So we were troubleshooting. And one of the things we did was buy the substance, which is androstenone, from another supplier. We did all kinds of things, but trying to figure out what had gone wrong. Now, with the subjects that we were testing, we did a lot of piloting and screening because a certain percentage of the population is anosmic for that.
Sorry, what is anosmia?
Anosmia is an inability to smell. And a specific anosmia is an inability to smell some particular substance. This is the case for androstenone. So it was part of the experiment. We wanted to look at people who were anosmic and people who were normosmic, which is have a normal sense of smell for the substance, and to see how this was reflected in brain activity. We did a lot to try to understand what had gone wrong in that study. But remember, I said that we were presenting the odors at a pretty low concentration. We were afraid the concentration was too low. And it's Johan Lundström, who's now a postdoc with me, said, well, one of the differences between all of that piloting that we did and the study itself in the scanner is that the people were lying down in the scanner and sitting up when they were in the lab being screened. So why don't we test people in the lab lying down and sitting up?
Where did that insight come from?
He's a bright guy.
But was it based on knowledge that other senses are similarly affected, or was it just
no.
a stab in the dark?
It was a stab in the dark, because we found that after we ran the study, we found that it was highly significant. We wrote our paper. Now, you're writing your paper, you want to know what's in the literature. Because this is not something that we would ordinarily be looking for in the literature, sitting up versus lying down. This is not what we're doing. You know, this is not our focus of our research. And so he looked for it because we were writing up the paper for our findings, and he found very little. There was this tiny, tiny literature of a couple of papers showing that this had been seen in audition and in a visual task. So that was after the fact.
As Dr. Jones-Gottman indicated, the two researchers did test Dr. Lundström's hypothesis before they published their paper. Using 36 healthy university students, 18 men and 18 women, they found that just about two-thirds suffered a decline in olfactory or smell sensitivity to the rose scent while lying down. Hence the caution about presenting your flowers. That's one implication of this discovery. But it wasn't the one the researchers had in mind when they published it. As neuroscientists, they do brain studies, including those involving the sense of smell. So as Dr. Jones-Gottman explains, it's important to know that the position of the test subject, upright or lying down, can affect the results.
Brain imaging is a very big business in science these days. A lot of people are doing brain imaging. And brain imaging is done, whether it's PET studies, that's positron emission tomography, or fMRI, which is functional magnetic resonance imaging, whether it's one or the other, the subjects being scanned are lying down in a scanner. So it's important for people doing brain imaging to realize that there's a difference in how people perceive your stimuli depending on body position.
When our noses and then brains process an odor, those scans reveal activity in specific regions of our brains. They light up, as it were. But even more fascinating is that different odors can turn on different lights.
You can have differences if the odor is nasty versus nice. You can have differences as a function of saying, tell me if you smell something good versus tell me if you smell something bad, so that their attention is drawn to one or another aspect.
And do you see big differences in the imaging at that point, or in your results, I should say? I mean, do people respond differently, significantly differently, to pleasure versus unpleasurable odors?
Yes. Yes, you can find that. There's not a great agreement in the literature about what the differences are, and I think it's because this is very complicated and subtle, and the brain is not the black box that we used to make it out to be years ago. And so you can change your results based on a lot of variables. This is why you have to be very careful in the design of your experiments so that you know exactly what you're controlling for.
That's why sitting up and lying down is important to you.
Yes, as a matter of fact, that's one reason. And it's also why one doesn't really want to make categorical statements about, let's say, the bad odor versus the good odor, because other factors can come into play, so that you find in the literature different people saying different things. We have a lot to sort out yet.
And I guess what may smell bad to one person may not necessarily smell bad to another person.
Well, that's very interesting. Yes, this is true. It's not across the board what's bad. It depends on your experience. And it depends on your expectation.
Any distinction between male and female? I know from my own personal experience that my wife's nose works a lot better than mine.
Well, not in the study that we just did. We didn't find a difference between men and women. We always look for this. In every study that we do, we try to have equal numbers of men and women so that we can make comparisons, because sometimes there are differences and sometimes there are not. And specifically in olfaction, if you have a huge group of subjects so that you're looking at group data, there are differences, and in favor, usually, in fact, of women. For example, the one I'm thinking about that is the most salient because it was so huge are studies of odor identification, which have been carried out by Richard Doty at the University of Pennsylvania. He has studied, you know, thousands of subjects, and he sees a very clear gender difference. You see the decrease in correct answers on his test with age, and you also see that women are better all along, and men, I believe, drop off a bit faster than women also. So there's a definite difference, but you have to consider how many of the odors might be odors that are more familiar to women. I think that's one of the main things that we find when we're doing odor identification, is that some odors, like odors used in cooking, women may be better at, although I would hate to say that women always do more cooking than men, and that's certainly not the case in my house. I guess just in general, there are some odors that you may find that men are going to smell more than women, and vice versa for identification. It's one of those kind of effects that is so small. It's there because you can find it in large groups and it's significant, but it's so small. You say in your household your wife is better than you are, so you notice it, but it isn't going to always be noticed.
I wonder if evolution has an explanation for that. I mean, I wonder if women pick up the smelly diaper before men do.
Well, if they smell it better, I would think that they would go the other direction faster.
Good point. Dr. Marilyn Jones-Gottman is a neuropsychologist at the Montreal Neurological Institute. The study on smell sensitivity and body position, co-written with Dr. Johan Lundstrom, is published in the journal Chemical Senses.
I love the brilliant man I'm married, the one who knows himself so well.
Well, science may have caused you to rethink your plans about presenting flowers, but as far as we know, music and poetry are appreciated in all planes. If you haven't the flair for rhyming couplets or odes to joy, Stephen Fraygood comes to the rescue with a couple of websites where you can have a poem or a song tailor-made for a price.
Sure, this e-card is kind of cute, but take it from the voice of experience. Cute does not inspire passion. Last year, I tried one of those online automatic poetry generators. I might as well have sent a gift-wrapped can of sardines. No, there is just no substitute for the human poet, like Alan Jessen at agiftofpoetry.com. Just send him details of your romance, and in a couple of days, you can read the first draft of a spanking new poem. Deathless lines like 10 years, 1 decade, 3,652 days. After all this time, I love you so, and I love you in so many different ways. The final handwritten poem in a gift box is only $130 with a money-back, no-quibble guarantee. How can you go wrong? Even better than a poem, though, wouldn't you like to write a love song? This song was created for a couple of newlyweds, one of them who works for Revenue Canada. Hey, you try working that into a song lyric.
He was born in the cold, cold north, and she in the cold, cold south. Although the border's got nothing to do with this song, it was the first thing out of my mouth. Dana met Terry while on holidays. She knew he was a man with all the facts. And even if he lacked in personality, at least he could prepare her income tax.
I'm Stephen Fraygood.
Dana loves Terry, loves Dana, loves Terry. And when they get married, they'll be Dana and Terry.
Well, that's enough of that. I think if I were you, I'd stick to the flowers. That is the program for this week. Thanks to associate producer Roman Pitt, our studio technician this week, Bernard Beauvais. If you'd like to get in touch with us with a comment, or if you have a science question you'd like us to answer for you, our email address is scitechfile, that's one word, at rcinet.ca. Our postal address is SciTech File, Radio Canada International, Post Office Box 6000, Montreal, Canada. Our postal code is H3C3A8. I'm Victor Nirenberg. Thank you for joining us.